Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanz on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, December 14, 2020. A rights group accuses the South Sudan's national security for abusing powers.
But since its establishment, the NSS has gone much further than merely collecting information. Within months of its establishment, its agents were arresting and imprisoning journalists, government critics and others, and conducting physical and telephonic surveillance.
And lecturers of Bahar al-Ghazal University go on strike for unpaid salaries.
We have suspended all the academic contacts from lectures, researches, assignments, tutorials, and any academic work until this fight is lifted.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's transitional government has welcomed the decision by the U.S. government to officially rescind the designation of Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism after being on the U.S. terror list for 27 years. In a statement released today, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sudan's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism is officially rescinded. The U.S. top diplomat said the move represents a fundamental change in U.S. bilateral relations towards greater collaboration and support for Sudan's historic democratic transition. The statement added, quote, "This achievement was made possible by the efforts of Sudan's civilian-led transitional government to chart a bold new course away from the legacy of the Bashir regime, and in particular to meet the statutory and policy criteria for rescission." On October 19, the Trump administration announced that Sudan would be removed from the U.S. list sponsor of terrorism in exchange for $335 million the Sudan government agreed to pay victims of terrorism attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya in 1998, as well as the victims of the USS Cole that was bombed by Al-Qaeda in 2000 off the coast of Yemen. Sudan's civilian Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok tweeted today saying, quote, "After 3 decades of global isolation on the state sponsors of terrorism list, Sudan officially joins the international community as a peaceful nation, supporting global stability. This achievement comes with enormous opportunities for Sudan's development, and we think everyone involved is making it happen," end of quote. The chairman of the Sudan Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, also wrote a tweet congratulating the Sudanese people on the delisting. Today's decision by the Trump administration came after a lapse of 45 days since the Trump administration notified Congress of his decision to remove Sudan from the terror list. Since then, U.S. lawmakers could not agree on a legislative language to restore Sudan's sovereign immunity by shielding it from future terror-related lawsuits. Human Rights Watch released a report Monday about South Sudan's National Security Service abuse of power. The report says the National Security has moved from its core function as information gathering agency to a tool of repression used by government to silence critics and journalists. The report says soon after it was established in 2011, the National Security Service acquired extensive and vague powers to conduct unlawful surveillance, commit abuses such as arbitrary detention, torture, and forced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, and abduction of victims inside South Sudan and in the neighboring countries. The international watchdog is calling for justice for alleged national security abuses and reforms in the service. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
The 78-page report entitled "What Crime Was I Paying For? Abuses by South Sudan's National Security Service" documents NSS abuses reported by detainees and families in South Sudan. Karen Kaneza Nantulia, Africa Advocacy Director within the African Division at Human Rights Watch, says South Sudan's National Security Service's job, like any intelligence agency around the world, should be to gather and analyze information and to advise law enforcement and other government institutions. But that's not exactly what happens.
But since its establishment, the NSS has gone much further than merely collecting information. Within months of its establishment, its agents were arresting and imprisoning journalists, government critics, and others, and conducting physical and telephonic surveillance. And today it has become one of the most important tools of repression of the government.
Human Rights Watch says it has interviewed 85 people, including former NSS detainees, family members of detainees, activists, and others who reported a wide range of abuses by the NSS that include torture, sexual abuse, and extrajudicial killings.
We documented abuses around against individuals who've been arrested and detained based on criticism of the government and perception of being anti-government or suspected rebels. Most arrests were not based on warrants or court orders, and detainees were held for long periods of time, even years, without charge and access to lawyers or visitors.
Nantulia says the NSS abuses against South Sudanese citizens extend to neighboring countries, namely Kenya and Uganda.
The report talks about enforced disappearances, cross-border harassment, and forced returns. At least 12 detainees died between 2017 and 2019. We documented 5 cases of disappearances, including the well-known cases of Don Samuel Wag and Agre Esbonidri, who were abducted from Kenya in 2017.
Nantulia says, despite the well-documented abuses of power by the NSS, the agency has not held any of its officers to account.
We were able to document how the NSS operates without judicial or meaningful legislative oversight, and how the officers, its officers, enjoy legal immunity from criminal and civil procedures for acts committed in connection with their work. And even when abuses by the NSS are reported and made public, the NSS rarely took disciplinary action or launched investigations or prosecutions against its own officers.
Nantulia is calling on the government to release detainees at NSS facilities, which include Juba's Blue House and the Riverside and Haijalaba facilities, or bring them into a court of law to face official charges. She is also urging South Sudan's government to hold abusive officers accountable and reform the NSS by reducing its powers and limiting its job to strictly information gathering and analysis. South Sudan in Focus reached out to the President's Office and the Minister of National Security for comment on the Human Rights Watch report without success. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Thousands of internally displaced persons in various camps in the Western Sudan region of Darfur have petitioned the United Nations Security Council to revoke a decision to end a UN mission in Darfur. The protesters say as the mission's mandate is coming to an end, IDPs continue to experience various forms of atrocities committed by Sudanese security forces. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Thousands of IDPs at Kalma Kam in South Darfur State have been protesting since last week, demanding the UN Security Council revoke its decision to end a joint UN African Union mission in Darfur, which is scheduled to wind down at the end of this month. Protesters say as the mission's mandate comes to an end, IDPs say Sudanese security forces continue to abuse them. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via messaging app from Kalma Kam on Monday, Adam Rijal, a spokesperson for the IDPs, says the protesters have petitioned regional and international authorities to consider extending the mission in Darfur. Rijal says the IDPs don't believe Sudanese security forces will protect them as the UNAMID head, noting security forces are the ones that carried out atrocities against civilians in Darfur, which led to thousands of people being displaced from their homes.
We demanded that the UNAMID should remain in Darfur till when a final and a sustainable peace is achieved in the country. We want to make sure that there are reforms in civilian, military and security institutions, where we can have patriotic forces that could really give us protection from atrocities. Then we can allow the mission to end its mandate in the Darfur region.
Rijal says the IDPs believe the transitional government is incapable of providing them with proper security because since President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in April 2019, Sudanese security forces have continued to carry out atrocities against local population and says the government has done nothing.
The transitional government itself is divided in military and civilian wing. They are not in a good harmony together, and the joint forces they want to deploy in Darfur are the same forces who actually carry genocide, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and war crimes against us in Darfur. Till now, we are still waiting for al-Bashir and his party men to be taken to the ICC to answer questions about this.
Addressing members of the UN Security Council last week, the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, confirmed Darfur is still experiencing atrocities, including sexual harassment of civilians.
My office has continued to monitor alleged crimes in Darfur, which may fall within the court's jurisdiction. There are repeated allegations of attacks on civilians in Darfur, occurring mainly in June and July. These attacks reportedly resulted in significant casualties. Alarmingly, there are continuing reports of sexual and gender-based violence and crimes against children.
Bensouda says such crimes must stop and protection of civilians must remain a priority. Protesters say they will continue protesting if the UN Security Council ignore their demands. Several phone calls made to UNAMID spokesperson Ashraf Issa for comment on this story were unsuccessful. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Ugandan journalists go on strike. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite meal?
I like chips and anything braai, whether chicken or beef.
My favorite meal is our fish, mainly chambo, and local vegetables like nkwani.
I love chapati. Like, I don't know why I love chapati, but I just love chapati. There's no reason for loving it. Like, chapati every day.
My favorite meal is jollof and rice with chicken. That will be best for me.
My favorite food, matoke, that is banana and beans. Banana and beans, yes.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Ugandan media houses and journalists are not happy about new government guidelines on accreditation of journalists to cover the 2021 presidential election and other state events. Daniel Alinaki is chairperson of Uganda's Editors Guild.
Our concerns about the move by the Media Council for Registered Journalists is basically threefold. The first is that while there is a law that gives the council the mandate to register journalists and give them practicing certificates, the names of the journalists to get the certificates are supposed to be given by an institution which pretty much no longer exists. So we are not sure that the directive by the council is actually legal as things stand. The second concern we have is that the timelines that have been given are quite difficult to meet. Asking journalists to basically sort out accreditation within 7 days in the middle of an election campaign does not sound like something that is feasible and that is useful. The third concern we have is pretty much the spirit within which this has been brought. It comes in the context of widespread violence against journalists, you know, covering the election campaign, over which the Media Council has been very, very quiet.
So, Daniel, the press release from the Media Council was on the 10th of December, and the journalists, they have until, or their current press passes will expire on the 31st of December. Are you saying that is not enough?
It's not enough. You have journalists that have already been accredited, who've been asked to go back in, basically cancel their accreditation and asked to renew their accreditation. I've looked at the form that they've been asked to fill in, and it has very personal details, you know, asking journalists whether they're married and the number of children that they have, and, you know, their physical, you know, home addresses. You know, that's quite worrisome. But, you know, primarily, the law gives the council the mandate, but it also creates a National Institute of Journalists of Uganda, which is supposed to be a peer body that has since gone into oblivion.
I know that for the 2021 election, there have been these requirements for political parties or candidates. Do these requirements impact the journalists in their coverage of the campaign?
Basically, we're having an election campaign in the middle of the pandemic, and the government has said, you know, we should have what it called a scientific campaign where people basically use the media to reach voters. But that was never going to happen because, you know, media access is not ubiquitous across the country. It's a very kind of disaggregated audience, different media houses. We're talking about 250 radio stations, many of which are owned by politicians that work close to the government and routinely do not give a chance to opposition politicians to appear on talk shows or even take advertising from them. So it's really, practically, it's come down to a rules to stop opposition candidates from campaigning, while the incumbent and the ruling party have, you know, a relatively much freer hand and access to media, including the public broadcaster.
That's Daniel Alenaki, chairperson of the Uganda Editors Guild. He spoke to my colleague, James Batty. Still on strike, academic staff at the University of Bahr el-Ghazal have gone on strike to protest the government's delay in paying their salaries. The Secretary General of the Academic Staff Association at the University of Bahr el-Ghazal says lecturers, professors and associate professors have not been paid for nearly 10 months. For VOA News, Dima Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Lecturer Apogi Kulang, the Secretary General for the Academic Staff Association at the University of Bahr el-Ghazal, says the strike brings all academic activities to a standstill.
We have suspended all the academic contacts from lectures, researches, assignments, tutorials, and any academic work until the strike is lifted.
Kulang says the government's failure to pay salaries for 9 months hurts lecturers and their families and affects the quality of academics at all public universities.
The situation of lecturers is horrible, especially in WAU, the University of Bahr el-Ghazal, simply because we are far from the center of the decision-making, that is Juba. And here with academic staff, we rely on this little salary, and it does not come. Now we are left with almost a week or more than a week bit to go for Christmas. That will completely make 9 months without salary. Our last salary was the one of March. Until now, we never received any salary.
Daniel Malong Achuot, chairman of the trade union at the University of Bahr el-Ghazal, a body that oversees the general welfare of both teaching and non-teaching staff at the institution, says the lecturers' strike is long overdue.
Academic staff called an emergency meeting yesterday, and they came out with a resolution of having a strike. And the reason of that strike was about actually the 9 months salaries, arrears of 9 months salaries.
Achot says the strike, which only involves academic staff, is aimed at pressuring the government in Juba to release the money that pays their salaries.
I think the issue is above administration. We are demanding the delayment of salaries. And it's above administration. What we are targeted is actually the government of South Sudan, not administration. Those who are paying us is the government, and those who are sending us money is the Minister of Finance direct.
A lecturer at the public university earns 200,000 South Sudanese pounds a month. An assistant professor earns 250,000, an associate professor gets 300,000, and a professor receives 400,000 SSP a month. Higher Education Minister Gabriel Changson Chang says he has received no official information about the strike, but admits the delay in paying academic salaries nationwide is a problem.
It is the whole country. I learned today that from the ministry that the 1 month salary has been released.
Chang says the country is going through economic hardship and all the government employees are demanding salary arrears. The strike comes at a time when students are preparing for end-of-year exams. Okech Adolfo is in his final year of medical school at the University of Barlgazal.
Students are just reluctant, so they have no other way they can do around. But we are hoping for the university to respond at least to this strike so that they have to put it off as we are approaching examination, because you can see most of the calendars for our timetable for examination are out already. We are supposed to start our exam by 1st of January. And if this situation is not intervened earlier, so it is also going to affect our exam.
Adolfo urged the university and the national government to intervene as soon as possible. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
U.S. President Donald Trump continued to hold out hope Sunday that he won the re-election bid last month, a day before the Electoral College meets to formally pick Democrat Joe Biden as America's 46th president. On Friday, U.S. Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit backed by President Donald Trump to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, ending a desperate attempt to get legal issues that state and federal judges had rejected before the nation's high court. In a brief order, the court said Texas does not have the legal rights to sue Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin because it has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which another state conducts its elections. Gerald Richard Paul is a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings College of Law, and he discussed the ruling and electoral college voting procedure and options for challenging it with International Edition's Steve Miller.
So the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is primarily as an appellate level court. It only hears appeals, except in cases that are brought by one state against another state. So this is a case brought by Texas, and the state of Texas was making the argument here that they were somehow injured by the way in which the other states conducted their election. And what the Supreme Court decided in this case is that that argument on its face is just fallacious, that there is no actual cognizable injury suffered by the state of Texas. So the court, in denying standing, was basically saying there's no case here. There's no injury suffered by Texas. They have no right to come into court.
Now, the other piece of that is that Justices Alito and Thomas said that they would have at least allowed Texas to file the complaint, but would not grant other relief. What do you interpret those remarks to mean?
What essentially that means is that Thomas and Alito were agreeing with the majority, the other seven justices in the court, insofar as they were saying there's no case here. But they were saying that it's a technical matter because the Constitution says that states can bring cases directly to the Supreme Court without having to go through the appeal process, that they should have allowed the case to be filed, but then simply not granted any relief.
Thank you. And we're talking about states and standing. Now, both President Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have said that the fight is not over, and possibly they would look at filing a new lawsuit in the District of Columbia where the president resides to give him standing. But so many of the president's legal challenges have been rejected by courts. So what do you make out of this legal strategy?
Well, it doesn't make any sense. The cases have now been rejected by nearly 60 courts, including about 58 judges who are Republican appointees. The theory of the case is essentially a denial of objective truth that Biden won the election and a denial of the principle of democracy under the law. The courts have repeatedly found that there was no evidence of widespread fraud. And the Department of Justice found the same thing.
One last question. In the United States, the citizens do not directly vote for the president. Rather, they vote for what are called electors. And on Monday, December 14th, the electors are voting for the president of the United States. I was wondering, as a constitutional legal expert, can you kind of explain the process and if any challenges to those elector slates can be made?
Well, that's a great question. Basically, Monday, the electors will meet in the state capitals. They will sign ballots indicating the person to whom they are obliged by law to vote for. And those ballots will then be certified by the governor of the states. And they will be put in envelopes and they will be mailed to the vice president, who is the president of the Senate. And what then happens is that on January 6th, there's a joint session of Congress. The envelopes will be open. The vice president will read out the ballots. They will be tabulated, and they will announce that Joe Biden has the majority of the votes. Now, members of the Senate or the House can object, but under the Electoral Vote Count Act, the law provides that if the electors have been certified, that is to say, if the election has been certified as valid by December 8, which has happened now for all of the states except for Hawaii, those electors are presumptively valid. And so unless a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate were to vote together to reject a slate of electors, those electors' votes will count. And since a majority of the House is dominated by Democrats, and it's not at all clear that a majority of Republicans in the Senate would vote to disallow any of the electoral votes, it's pretty clear that there's no way to avoid the result that the president-elect will be Joe Biden.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Mama Ama by Colonel Mido. We've been listening to Colonel Mido with the song Mama Ama. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.